another case. So that's a lot of work in terms of the legal fight. But there's something to be said that a small international investigative publisher is able to keep going under that pressure, and not only keep going, but to expand. Not many publishers have been expanding in the past 5 years.
Founder, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange speaking inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's taken refuge for the past 3 years. When we went inside the embassy on Memorial Day, British police asked the Ecuadorian embassy to hand over our identification. We refused. Just hours before we went to air today, WikiLeaks released more than a half a million U.S. State Department cables from 1978. Tune in tomorrow, Thursday, for part two of our interview with the WikiLeaks founder. We'll speak with Julian Assange about the cables, as well as the leaked Sony documents, the new ICWatch database, which calls personal details from LinkedIn, posted by former members of the U.S. intelligence community, and the inside story about why the United States forced President Evo Morales to land during the 2013 hunt for Edward Snowden. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Hani Massoud, Mike Burke, Brendan Allen, Julie Crosby, Sam Alkoff, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Neil Shabata. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland.
Hey, KB listeners, this is Stella from the Youth Collective reminding you to tune in Wednesday, May 27th from 6 to 7 p.m. for our public affairs show. We have a whole collection of interesting pieces on politics this month ready for your ears. We'll talk about recent events in Baltimore, explore the history of politically fueled music, and share our opinions on corruption. It's a show you will not want to miss. So sit back, turn up the volume, and turn into KBOO 90.7 FM, Wednesday, May 27th from 6 to 7 p.m. for your slice of current events on the underground.
KBOO is proud to partner with Hopworks Urban Brewery for their Community Tap program. Every month, Hopworks features a local nonprofit organization, and May's Community Tap is your community radio, KBOO. Hopworks is located at 2944 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. For more information on Hopworks and their Community Tap program, you can go to kboo.fm/hub.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lentz International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm, every Sunday at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Opening day is this Sunday, May 31st. Lentz Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community produce booth open for home gardeners, cooking demos, and live music. More at lentzfarmersmarket.org.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a German court has dismissed a case brought by the families of three Yemenis killed by U.S. drone strikes in 2012.
The Obama administration has enacted a new executive action which will broaden efforts to clean American waterways.
And after 5 years in military custody, Chelsea Manning has written an open letter.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 27, 2015. I'm Jimmy Tardy.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Yesterday, the Portland police began a comprehensive sweep of homeless encampments near the city's bridges and in the Central East Side Industrial District. The sweep is slated to last weeks and is the biggest effort coordinated by the city since 2013, when police targeted homeless people sleeping near City Hall and encampments on the city's east side. Portland Police Bureau spokesman Sergeant Pete Simpson has said that the sweeps are in coordination with nonprofits and are intended to connect individuals to social services. However, he said that the homeless people who people contacted could be subject to arrest over outstanding warrants or cited for violating the city's camping ban. He also said that in order to deter bicycle theft, bikes belonging to homeless people would be confiscated if officers believe them to be stolen. Ibrahim Mubarak, co-founder of Homeless Rest Area Right to Dream 2, says the motives behind the city's actions aren't as benign as city leaders are making them out to be. He spoke with KBOO's Mike Klepfer about the sweeps.
So can you start off detailing what the Portland police have been up to in terms of the sweeps that just started yesterday?
Portland police been up to cattling the houseless people again to different location where I don't know, but they routing them up, taking all their belongings, and when I went out there yesterday, they had animal control where they was taking the houseless people dogs. If you didn't have a receipt for your bike, they was taking their bike and telling them they couldn't sleep there anymore. But this is a common event that they do to the houseless community every time this year when they want to make it seem like Portland have no houseless problem. So they want to hide, get the people out the way, and the best way they think that can happen is by taking all their belongings, telling them to move on. But those people in their right mind come back to the social service hub, which is downtown, saying, I don't have this, I don't have that, the police took this. So they're looking for help. And that brings more people into the downtown area, the same area they're trying to cleanse of the houseless community.
Where was the site that you saw this happen at yesterday?
Under the Hawthorne Bridge, right by the fire station. They was in riot gear. They had four-wheelers. They had the inmates come take people's stuff. They was treating the houseless people with respect once we got there. We had cameras and witnesses. But before we came, they was being cruel to them.
Now, you said that this roundup is routine, and it usually happens around the time of the Rose Festival and the parade, right?
It goes to what Right to Survive and Right to Dream 2 have been saying, is that the minute you lose your housing, you lose your rights. And what they're saying, the houseless community have no right to be in this city. They don't have no right to get proper rest, to get proper medical attention, to get a decent shower, to look for a chance to look for housing and shelter and employment.
What the city is saying is that these sweeps have to do with an influx of calls that they've gotten, and they're sweeping the typical areas under the bridges on either side of the river, but they're also doing sweeps in the central east side industrial area. And what I want to ask you is, do you think that sudden influx of calls is in relation to the Central Eastside Industrial Council raising opposition to the prospective new site of Right to Dream 2?
I don't think that's the problem. I just think it's kind of ironic how these calls often come in around the same time this year. But that's what you get when you sweep a community and they have to find place, you get differences in influx. And if you don't have no type of organized structure, you're going to get chaotic behavior and chaos in the environment because people are thinking self-survival. They're not thinking community-wise. And that's where Right to Survive and Right to Dream 2 come in there to try to organize those people. However, again, this is a norm thing. I would like to see those calls. They should produce those calls so we can check and see if they true or the city just lying as they usually do in order to do things to people that's experienced poverty and homelessness.
And finally, I understand that Right to Survive and Right to Dream 2 have your annual Pitch a Tent event coming up. Do you want to talk about that at all?
That's another a thing that the city do, what they say they have no control of. They allow people to pitch tents once a year overnight in order to wake up and see the Rose Parade on public sidewalk. They allow things, as a means of recreation and to generate money, finance, capital. That's what capitalists do. But they're not worried about people putting up tents and structured as a means of survival. So this lets me know that corporate rights are more important than human rights.
Okay, Ibrahim. Well, I want to thank you for your time.
No problem.
For KBU News, I'm Mike Klepfer.
A former Portland police officer who was fired over an incident in which he shot a man with live shotgun rounds he said he thought were, quote, less lethal beanbag rounds, killed himself Monday, according to a report today released by the Clark County Medical Examiner. Officer Dane Reister was found dead next to railroad tracks in Washougal, Washington, on Monday. An autopsy confirmed he had walked in front of an oncoming train and was killed instantly Monday morning. In 2011, Reister shot William Monroe, a man experiencing a mental health crisis in southwest Portland. Monroe suffered what his attorney said was a, quote, softball-sized hole in his leg, among other injuries, and nearly died from his wounds. Police later instituted reforms that would disallow officers from carrying less lethal rounds and live ammunition together in the same bag. The incident was the subject of the largest lawsuit settlement payout in the city's history. Monroe was awarded $2.3 million by a federal judge. Reister was fired in 2013 and criminally indicted on assault charges stemming from the incident. He was awaiting a ruling on the charges at the time of his death. Reister was 44 years old and leaves behind a wife and several children.
Efforts by the United States Postal Service to close mail plants in Eugene and Bend have been put on hold following pressure from the community. Retired postal worker Jamie Partridge was quoted as saying, "Growing resistance to the dismantling of the People's Postal Service is bearing fruit." Following demands of a coalition of postal unions, retirees, rural associates, and small businesses, Oregon's entire congressional delegation met with Postal Service administrators in mid-May. Over the next 2 days, rallies and marches in over 50 cities across the country led to the USPS declaring that they had backed off the closure schedule on May 22nd. The slowdown, which postpones any further closures to an undetermined date, comes after nearly half of the nation's mail processing and distribution centers were closed between 2012 and 2013. Voices are now being raised to demand the closed plants be reopened and that abandoned service standards, such as the delivery of overnight first-class in-town mail, be restored. The Reverend John Schweibert decried the Postal Service's recent strategy as causing hardships for customers, especially elderly, disabled, rural, and small business customers, and noted that the cuts have come in response to a manufactured crisis in the Postal Service. The cuts have been implemented by the Postal Service as a result of a 2006 congressional decree that the Postal Service pre-fund retiree benefits for 75 years in advance, a requirement that is made on no other federal system.
City official Ellis McCoy will serve 2 years in prison for his part in a bribery scandal. Prosecutors claimed that over the course of 10 years, McCoy took over $200,000 in cash and incentives to help a Florida-based company land a contract for parking meters in the city. The judge sentenced him to 2 years in prison, saying that with public confidence shaken, probation was not a serious enough consequence for his actions. The parking meters in question are the city's smart meters, which accept cash and credit cards and dispense a sticker for drivers to place in their window. Overall, the meters are hailed as a success as they require less work to maintain and collect money from. While McCoy did express remorse for the bribery scandal, he stood by the success of the meters.
The Portland City Council is restricting the number of people allowed to sit in on its meeting discussing the proposal to disconnect reservoirs. The City of Portland has begun a project to disconnect Mount Tabor's reservoirs in an effort to close all open-air reservoirs. According to the Oregonian, this action is very unpopular with nearby communities, and meeting discussing the issues are often full. The decision to limit people allowed in the meeting comes after previous meetings over this topic included shouting matches and name-calling. The City Council meeting over the future of the reservoirs will happen tomorrow at 2 p.m.
The Bureau of Land Management has just released a long-awaited plan for public forests throughout western Oregon. The plan looks at six options for managing federal land that includes special places like the Wild Rogue River, Applegate Valley, and Illinois Valley. Most of these options include slashing streamside buffers and clear-cutting thousands of acres of BLM land. Jeannie Moy with Klamath Siskiyou Wild is encouraging Oregonians to submit public comments on the plan. These comments must be submitted by July 23rd.
The plan has been a long time coming. It's a management plan for kind of all aspects of the BLM lands that is put out every 20 years. So this is kind of the first major plan since the Northwest Forest Plan in the mid-1990s. And it's a 1,400-page document, so I want to tell you I haven't read the whole thing, but some of the important takeaways are that there's proposals to cut more trees and areas that are late successional reserves and areas that are buffers to streams and rivers than are currently being cut. So it concerns us for the protection of our waters, our water supply for fish and for habitat and for the general well-being of our communities in Southern Oregon. Late successional reserves, or LSRs, are designated for species that like late successional trees, often known as old-growth forests, and they are incredibly rich and diverse in species, and they are excellent habitat for species that we manage for, such as the northern spotted owl, as well as many other species that have seen threats in the last 50 years. There are six different alternatives, so almost six different possibilities for how the land will be managed. And we're in the middle of a comment period right now, so this is a time when anyone in the public can make comments on any part of the management plan and assert what they think is important or things that maybe they feel were left out of the management plan. And so the plan, the draft plan is not a final decision. But we're in the middle of the period where people can make comments, and so we're trying to just engage people in this democratic process that we have for our public lands.
And what are the areas that we're talking about in this plan?
This is the Western Oregon BLM, the Bureau of Land Management lands. So there's vast tracts of land throughout the state that the BLM manages. And compared to the rest of the West, in Oregon, BLM lands include a lot more forest lands. And so the forest and lumber industries have a lot more at stake in this planning process. We have a form on our website that allows people to write a letter very easily, just a couple clicks, and we have some information on the page. They can just submit a kind of form letter that we have, or you can modify it and write your own. If you also want to write a formal letter to the BLM, you can do so through their website. They have a planning website that has the entire plan on the website, as well as an interactive map for different alternatives in their plan. And for those who are inclined, you can also just handwrite them a letter and mail it as well.
That was Jeannie Moy with KS Wild. More information and a form to submit comments on the forest plan can be found on their website, kswild.org.
The Port of Portland is pushing a bill in the Oregon legislature to be able to keep dumping dredge waste in West Hayden Island's natural area along the Columbia River north of Portland. Last year, the City of Portland pulled West Hayden Island from its list of lands to be developed over the next 20 years. That move created a problem for the Port of Portland, which was depending on a provision in the environmental quality laws allowing the port to dump the waste on West Hayden Island. But that provision only applies if the land being dumped on will be developed in the near future and the solid waste can be used in that development. Now that the West Hayden Island is a protected site, that provision no longer applies. Emily Green from Street Roots newspaper spoke with KBOO about the research she has done on the issue.
The Port of Portland routinely dredges the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, which means dredging ships basically gather up sediment from the bottoms of the rivers to relocate it so that ships navigating can get through. It's also a pretty important part of maintaining a port. So for more than 75 years now, portions of that dredged sediment have been placed on West Hayden Island, which in fact is mostly made up of the dredged material. The dredged sediment is considered to be solid waste by the Department of Environmental Quality, and it's also known to contain PCBs, heavy metals, and pesticides, including DDT, which, as you know, was banned in 1972 after Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring documented its detrimental effects on people and the environment. So in 2009, Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality began to regulate solid waste dumping, including port dumping of dredged material. After that, solid waste dumped outside of a landfill has to meet requirements listed under their beneficial use laws. The DEQ policy analyst Tom Roik told me that means three things. The waste has to be characterized, it must not pose an environmental or health risk, and whoever is dumping it has to have a plan for its future use. In other words, it can't just sit at the dump site indefinitely. So the port, which owns West Hayden Island, has met these requirements by stating that the sediment will be used as construction filler when the island is developed in the future. And while environmental groups have brought lawsuits saying that the plan was speculative in nature, and speculative uses are not allowed under the beneficial use laws, DEQ has allowed it to continue to do so, allowing that future use as meeting the requirements. So now that the city of Portland has gone on the record to say the island won't be developed in the next 20 years, and the port had already abandoned its plans to build marine terminals on the island January 2014, so with no development in the foreseeable future, the port could no longer say that all the sediment it's been dumping there is going to be used as construction filler on the island. So without any future use for the sediment, dumping there would become illegal. So the port created a bill that would exempt Oregon ports' dredged sediment from any DEQ oversight and brought that bill to Senator Arne Roblin down in Coos Bay, and he introduced it as Senate Bill 412. DEQ pushed back initially, and the bill was amended to only exempt the waste from having to meet that third requirement under the beneficial use law that it have a productive future use. So other entities would still have to meet this requirement, but Oregon ports could just ignore it. This would mean that the port could continue to stockpile sediment on the island indefinitely as long as it meets the other requirements. And environmentalists would then lose the only leg they had to stand on in fighting this practice. So the productive use requirement, according to Tom Roik at DEQ, was put in place for a reason. It's to stop people from doing exactly what the port wants to do, which is, it refers to as sham disposal. It's where someone is trying to figure out the cheapest way to dispose of waste, and the requirement would keep them from being able to do this and just stockpile sediment. So the reason that environmentalists are fighting it is that today the island is a diverse habitat of bottomland hardwood trees, wetlands, and meadows that are homes to very diverse wildlife. Director of the Portland Audubon Society, Bob Salinger, says there are more than 100 species of birds on the island, and it provides habitat for salmon. He argues this is no place to dump solid waste, and he's really been at the forefront of leading the opposition to this bill once he found out about it, which, you know, was after the Senate had already voted unanimously to pass it.
That was Emily Green, a reporter from Street Roots, speaking about her article in this week's paper, titled Line in the Sand, the Port of Portland Wants to Change the Law So We Can Keep Dumping Dredge Waste in West Hayden Island's Scenic Area.
A proposed dam in Silverton, Oregon has led to opposition by some area farmers. The dam would be 70 feet tall and create a reservoir of 384 acres. The area in question is the Victor Point that features a canyon that Drift Creel runs through. The debate is whether the creek should be dammed, which would flood the canyon bottom. The farmers would lose their nursery, vegetable, and grass seed crops. Environmentalists say the dam would destroy fish habitat. Agricultural interests use about 85% of Oregon's water.
The Obama administration has enacted a new executive action which will broaden efforts to clean American waterways. The new regulations will allow the Environmental Protection Agency to protect smaller bodies of water that were not previously covered by the 1972 Clean Water Act. The EPA has stated that the new regulations will not affect most agriculture and that it was designed to ensure that farmers and ranchers are not adversely affected. Opponents have called for an alternate plan to be created by the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers.
Environmental and human rights groups held a protest this morning at the annual shareholder meeting of the Chevron Corporation. They introduced shareholder resolutions on accountability, environmental, and human rights issues. The group called on Chevron to pay the $9 billion in damages ordered by an Ecuadorian court for the company's toxic dumping in the Amazon rainforest. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with one of the members of Amazon Watch who attended the shareholder meeting this morning.
Could you tell us a little bit about the action that Amazon Watch and other groups took at the shareholders meeting?
Amazon Watch was here outside the Chevron headquarters in San Ramon as part of a growing coalition of environmental and human rights organizations, right now under the umbrella of the True Cost of Chevron Network. Many protesters stood outside in solidarity with a group of investors and others who went inside to confront Chevron's management and as well as other shareholders about the activities of the company that have been harmful to the environment, to communities, to democracy, free speech, and to our society, citing that the true cost of Chevron is too high. On behalf of many different resolutions asserting the company needs to make changes in its environmental governance and human rights practices, many of us stood up and addressed directly Chevron CEO John Watson, as well as members of the board, pressuring the company to make changes.
And just to talk a little bit about the Ecuadorian situation, I understand Chevron received a judgment against it to pay $9.5 billion in Ecuador. What was that judgment for?
In 1992, when Texaco, which merged later with Chevron, left, the indigenous and farmer communities sued them in New York City for creating a toxic disaster. There was a judgment issued against Chevron, ultimately for $9.5 billion. It's been upheld by an appellate court and by Ecuador's Supreme Court. And it is now a verdict that the Ecuadorians are seeking to enforce outside of Ecuador because Chevron took its assets and fled the country, fearing that it would have its assets seized to cover the liability. The problem is the legal saga has dragged on for decades, and Chevron has every intention to continue doing that because it can afford to litigate till the end of time. This is a company worth $210 billion. And there's been entire legal careers made on fighting this. But in the meantime, the Ecuadorian communities continue to live with toxic contamination and suffer and die from it.
And if this were a criminal case with an individual that fled the country like Chevron did, they would have extradition laws to bring them back to face justice. Is there any extradition law for corporate criminal activity like this?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Essentially, this case is probably the most important corporate accountability case to date. The reason being that what Chevron is trying to do is use a legal shell game to say, we can't be held responsible anywhere. If you find us liable one place, we'll simply move ourselves somewhere else. And they're trying to protect their assets, saying that Chevron in Canada, for example, is different than Chevron in the United States and shouldn't be held liable for its practices. So therefore, it can't be touched, which would, of course, mean any corporation can get away with doing the same thing, commit violations, commit atrocities, commit human rights violations and environmental destruction, and simply move your headquarters somewhere else or close up shop and move to a different country to escape accountability. If they're allowed to get away with that, who knows what they could get away with elsewhere and never be held to account.
Well, I do want to thank you for this update. Again, I have been speaking with Paul Pazimuno. He is with Amazon Watch, speaking to us from outside of the shareholders meeting in San Ramon, California. This morning, Amazon Watch confronted Chevron for a failure to pay a judgment against them of over $9 billion in Ecuador for the destruction of the Amazon rainforest and the poisoning of the populations there. You can find more information on the website truecostofchevron.com. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with, it's going to be with Delphine tonight, I believe, followed by The Underground on at 6. At 7 o'clock, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be generally sunny with a high of 84 and light winds, moving to scattered clouds and 57 at night. Today in history, in 1995, American actor Christopher Reeve was thrown from his horse, leaving him quadriplegic. He would later become an activist on behalf of people with spinal cord injuries. Our quote of the day is from Mark Twain, who said, "It's better to keep your mouth closed and let people think you are a fool than to open it and remove all doubt."
It's 5:30. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Like some vaudeville shtick, Barack Obama keeps blathering that a huge flaw in his global trade scam doesn't exist. But then, the flaw hits him in the face like a big cream pie. The president's trade scam is called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it's a corporate boondoggle loaded with gotchas that hurt workers, consumers, our environment, and others. But its most damnable flaw is that it would allow foreign corporations to sue the U.S. in corporate-run tribunals to make us change or even repeal any of our laws that might pinch their profits. "No, no," shouts Obama, "there is no chance, zero chance, of that happening." But, splat, splat, reality has smacked him in the face with two cream pies. Using an earlier trade scam, the World Trade Organization has ruled not once but twice this year that two U.S. laws must be repealed or modified to satisfy the profit goals of corporations in Mexico and Canada. On May 12, a WTO trade tribunal ruled that our Dolphin Safe Tuna Labeling Law, which lets you and me know that the tuna we buy has not been fished with nets that trap and kill dolphins, violates the free trade right of Mexican tuna fleets to use the cheaper dolphin slaughtering nets. And 2 weeks later, another WTO tribunal hurled a second cream pie. This one smacks Cool, an American consumer law that requires country of origin labeling on meat products so your family and mine can know where the meat we buy comes from. Our Congress passed this sensible right-to-know law. Our courts have upheld it. 92% of Americans support it, but a group of corporate lawyers on a WTO tribunal has overruled us. This is Jim Hightower saying, now Obama wants his TPP to create more corporate kangaroo courts. To tell him, don't TPP on me, go to tradewatch.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
After 5 years in military custody, Chelsea Manning has written an open letter published in The Garden. In The Guardian. The letter goes on to describe the events that followed one of the United States' largest confidential data leaks in history. In 2010, Bradley Manning released thousands of documents to the site WikiLeaks. Manning had used a burnable CD to take copies of sensitive military information and smuggled it out by marketing it as a Lady Gaga CD. Manning was arrested under suspicion of treason and aiding the enemy. Charges of aiding the enemy can result in a life sentence without release. Ultimately, Manning was sentenced to 35 years for leaking classified documents. The day after sentencing, Manning made more news by publicly announcing his desire to transition to a woman while in military prison. After another year and a half court battle, Manning won the right to receive hormone therapy. Manning, now known as Chelsea, wrote in The Guardian an article of how the military treated her, including living in a cage in Kuwait and threats of having her disappear in Guantanamo. Chelsea Manning may be released after serving just 8 of the 35-year sentence.
A German court has dismissed a case brought by the families of 3 Yemenis killed by U.S. drone strikes in 2012. Complainants accused the German government of complicity in civilian deaths from the U.S. drone strikes and had asked the court to condemn the use of the U.S. airbase in Ramstein to coordinate the attacks. The case marks the first time a government lending support to the U.S. drone program has even allowed such a challenge to be heard in court.
The flood that devastated Central Texas this past weekend is yet another extreme weather incident prompting more urgent discussion of climate change. The flooding, described to have tsunami-like power, marks the end of a four-year drought in the country's south-central region. While topping off depleted reservoirs, it comes at great cost. Over 22 people in Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma have died, with a dozen still missing. Gage Mueller, a Houston resident of 40 years, said, "We've seen flooding before, but not nearly to this extreme." This very same week, the World Meteorological Organization kicked off its international conference in Switzerland. In agreement with Mueller's description, the conference is appropriately titled Facing Up to Climate Change, Extreme Weather. Meteorologists from around the world will discuss the effects of atmospheric and oceanic warming and will touch upon the role of humans in the climate shift. In the words of WMO Secretary General Michael Jarraud, "The list of extreme events is long, and there is growing scientific evidence that at least some of them would have been unlikely without human-induced climate change." The numbers are indeed concerning. The level of atmospheric CO2 this past month was 400 parts per million, a concentration that surpasses all measurements for 2.5 million years. Think Progress reported another shocking finding. The number of storms that drop more than 3 inches of rain has increased by 50% during the period of 2001 to 2010. Giraud of the WMO urges contemporary audiences to take action against the harmful effects of climate change. He says, "We have a moral duty to take action to limit climate change. If we don't do it, we will be judged by our children and our grandchildren."
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear a case that could redefine the way voting districts are drawn. The lawsuit was brought by Sue Evanwell and is heavily supported by the Project on Fair Representation, which is a conservative organization based in Texas. The organization is against any racial and ethnic classifications, including programs such as affirmative action. It has been the driving force behind numerous lawsuits to reverse race-based legal protections. Its director, Ed Blum, coordinated the legal challenge that ended up overturning the Voting Rights Act of 1956. The latest lawsuit aims to clarify the practice of drawing districts based on the one-person, one-vote doctrine established in the 1960s. One-person, one-vote currently bases the borders of voting districts on having equal population sizes. The lawsuit seeks to challenge this practice to base the district lines on equal numbers of registered voters only. Evanwell and supporters claim this will ensure voter equality. Statistically, this change would give more say to rural areas with higher proportions of registered voters and take political power from urban centers, which include higher numbers of immigrants, racial minorities, and young people. The Supreme Court will begin hearing the case in its next term, starting in October.
A newly released report finds that the New York School of Horace Mann may have had as many as 64 cases of sexual abuse between 1960 and 1990. Initial reports from 2013 indicated 25 cases, which were never prosecuted due to New York's statute of limitations. The initial report gave the accusations momentum, and soon after, a committee was formed by a group of former students who were also abused. In the wake of the initial report, a group was also formed to help victims pay for their counseling. The worst parts of the report found that accused teachers and staff were allowed to continue working at the school, parents were not given copies of statements by their children, and no cases were forwarded to law enforcement. The school settled with one student this year, known only as John Doe, for somewhere between $10 and $15 million.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, May 27, 2015. Israeli fighter jets bombard Gaza, and in the West Bank, troops demolish a Palestinian-owned house. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
The Israeli Air Force carried out on Wednesday at dawn a series of airstrikes targeting different areas of the besieged coastal strip. Media sources said that Israeli F-16 fighters fired missiles into several areas in Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip and in the northern Beit Lahia town. The Israeli missiles attacks targeted areas Israel says it's used by Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza for training. The army also fired 3 missiles into Palestinian agricultural lands close to the destroyed Gaza International Airport east of Rafah, causing damage. The Israeli missiles caused property damage to a number of homes and buildings and anxiety attacks among civilians, mainly the children. The Israeli army said that the shelling was in retaliation for at least one shell allegedly fired from Gaza into urban areas in the Lachash Regional Council of Settlements in the Negev. Although Hamas was not behind the alleged rockets, Israel held the movement responsible for the escalation, said it will retaliate, and added that Hamas is responsible for whatever happens in the Gaza Strip. Also in Gaza on Wednesday, Israeli Navy ships opened fire on several Palestinian fishing boats in Gaza territorial waters near the Beit Lahia shore in northern part of the coastal region. The fishers had to sail back to shore to avoid further Israeli fire. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Wednesday 11 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank, in addition to one woman while visiting her imprisoned son in the Israeli Galbua Army prison, and one woman on Erez Terminal in northern Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn the town of Silwan, south of Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem, and demolished an under-construction Palestinian house. Family members said that they started building their 80 square meters property 3 months ago and never received any warning or notices from the city council. The soldiers and the bulldozers left the town after demolishing the property, eyewitnesses reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, May 27th, 2015 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
A popular ad-blocking program known as AdBlock Plus has won its case in German court. AdBlock Plus was sued for blocking the revenue streams of popular websites. According to the plaintiffs, blocking ads on websites limits that site's ability to provide free content to users. The court ruled that AdBlock Plus did not have significant power in the market. AdBlock Plus does allow some advertisements through its software in situations where it has approved an advertiser. Getting approval requires that ads do not use animation, make noise, or do other things that slow page loading and ruin the user experience. AdBlock Plus is free software and recently became available for Android devices with an Apple version currently in development.
14 people, including several officials with the international soccer sanctioning body FIFA, have been indicted by the United States Justice Department for their role in bribery and racketeering charges. The charges were unsealed as police in Zurich, Switzerland, conducted early morning raids at hotels where the officials were staying while attending FIFA's annual conference. The Justice Department says that the investigation dates back some 20 years and that more indictments are forthcoming. The charges allege that more than $150 million worth of fraud and allege that numerous FIFA officials demanded bribes in the awarding of contracts relating to sports marketing firms' media rights to FIFA tournaments. The investigation will also determine whether corruption was a factor in awarding the 2018 and 2022 World Cup tournaments to Russia and Qatar, respectively. FIFA had already courted controversy over the 2018 Qatar World Cup, as investigations into working conditions at World Cup stadiums reveal the widespread use of slavery and rampant conditions that have led to hundreds of worker deaths. The Justice Department is claiming jurisdiction in the case because U.S. bank accounts were used. Nike is also thought to be a target of the investigation. The indictment cites a U.S.-based sports apparel company bribed a Brazilian soccer official for a sponsorship deal in 1996, the same year Nike announced a partnership with Brazil's Soccer Federation. The company allegedly paid more than $160 million over 10 years to the official exclusively to sell Brazilian national team apparel and footwear.
With very little publicity or fanfare, the U.S. Air Force launched its mysterious space plane into orbit last week, carrying no crew but filled with unknown equipment. This marks the fourth such flight launched by the secretive military research program. According to the Associated Press, the reporter's calls to the Air Force were met with no comment. The space plane that was launched into orbit is an X-37B, which looks like a miniature space shuttle. It launches vertically but lands horizontally. One of the experiments on board the plane is a Mylar sail that measures around 32 meters. Once the plane is in orbit, the sail will be deployed and then will be propelled by the sun.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Galen Sanford, Jimmy Tardy, and Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111, and Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM.